Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, July 19th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Texas's leaders seek answers from EPA. Delegation. PB's designation would harm area's economy, drive energy prices higher. By Mella McEwen. Members of Texas's delegation are protesting the Environmental Protection Agency's possible redesignation of the Permian Basin as being in non-attainment. Their protest came in a letter to EPA Administrator Michael Regan, led by Representative August Pfluger, the Republican whose District 11 includes Midland and other parts of the Permian Basin. The letter noted that the Permian Basin accounts for over 40% of U.S. oil production and 15% of natural gas production. The designation, they wrote, would significantly burden Permian producers, slowing production and reducing supply in a region that is a key geopolitical tool for the U.S. and its allies. The Biden administration is all too eager to transform the EPA into a club to bludgeon the fossil fuel industry with, Pfluger told the Reporter Telegram by email. Now President Biden is threatening a non-attainment designation that will devastate our local economy and drive prices even higher for consumers. The last thing the Permian Basin needs is more harmful regulations. My message to President Biden, abandon your promise to end fossil fuels and work with the innovators and entrepreneurs in the Permian Basin. Pfluger was joined as signers of the letter by both Texas Senators John Cornyn and Ted Cruz and Representatives Yvette Harrell, Jody C. Arrington, Kevin Brady, Roger Williams, Tony Gonzalez, Ronnie L. Jackson, Louis Gohmert, Jake Elzey, Randy Weber, Chip Roy, and Brian Babin. Not only did the letter writers protest the possible redesignation, but they asked the EPA to respond to some key questions by July 29th. Why, of June 30th, the EPA had not notified either the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality or the New Mexico Environment Department of the proposed redesignation. Wild Earth Guardians reportedly petitioned EPA for the designation in March 2021, warning 6 months later it would sue to force action. What critical stakeholder groups, including local healthcare providers and economists, provided input on the necessity and impact of this redesignation? What specific counties or areas in the Permian Basin are being considered for redesignation for the 2015 Ozone National Ambient Air Quality Standards? Has the EPA received data or evidence warranting a redesignation? If so, what is that data or evidence? Has the EPA received data or evidence demonstrating ground-level ozone above 0.070 ppb in Texas counties within the Permian Basin production area? If so, what is that data or evidence? The issue is of critical importance, not only to the Permian Basin counties, but to all U.S. energy consumers, they wrote. It is inconceivable that the EPA would attempt to limit production when American consumers and families are facing record-high energy prices, they wrote. This article is entitled, P&Z OKs Rezoning for Bush Tennis Expansion, by Mella McEwen. Transformation of the Bush Tennis Center into a premier athletic complex can now get underway following action from the Planning and Zoning Commission. Commissioners at Monday's meeting unanimously approved a request by Newton Engineering for a zone change from PD, Planned Development District for a Recreation Center in part, and MF16, Multiple Family Dwelling District in part, to Local Retail District, to allow for expansion at the Tennis Center located at 5700 Briarwood Avenue in Northwest Midland. The Reporter-Telegram in June reported materials have been delivered for the expansion, which will include 5 indoor basketball/volleyball courts, a 50-yard indoor turf room, and a 12,000-square-foot high-performance training facility. Situated on 35 acres, Bush Tennis Center includes 19 full-size lighted tennis courts. Upon completion of the expansion, the center will be the second-largest tennis center in the world, with more than 60 courts, including covered courts and indoor clay courts. Commissioners also unanimously approved a request by George and Mary Barton for the initial zoning of a 2.27-acre tract out of 10 acres at Dumfries Road near Highway 158 as AE, Agricultural Estates District. The couple seek to utilize city facilities for a house already on the property. The site is being annexed into city limits, thus requiring an initial zoning, and is in the process of being platted. This article is entitled, "Gwyn Announces Departure from Local Airwaves," by Stuart Doreen. Tatum Gwyn has changed how the news is broadcast in Midland, Odessa. Those who have watched news broadcasts for decades have seen Gwyn at 5 p.m. and 10 p.m. giving the information of the day her way. It's been a conversation, like she is talking to her family, maybe her grandmother, an avid watcher of her broadcast, she said. This past week, Gwyn, 32, announced that conversation will end in August. She has found her next broadcasting challenge, and that will take place in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Gwyn, 32, was raised professionally in the newsrooms of Midland, Odessa, from the day she talked her way into an internship at KOSA. There, she saw firsthand Jay Hendricks and Tatum Hubbard raise the stature of the Odessa station. Her career included anchoring the morning show. But after Hubbard made the transition to information and marketing at the University of Texas Permian Basin, she brought Gwyn along. "After I got off the phone, I said, 'I got to go,'" Gwyn said about the offer to leave local television news, at least temporarily. Not long after, Gwyn got that second call that helped define her career. She knew she wasn't done with journalism, and KWES News Director Melissa Hendricks Beach, a former anchor at KWES, called to see if Gwyn wanted to give her another shot. "I said, 'If you make me your main anchor,'" Gwyn said. "It was a long shot, but when I got off my first call with Melissa, I said, 'I have to do this.'" The elevation to the 10 p.m. anchor was one that Gwyn called an opportunity earned. She respects the position of main anchor while also understanding what she could do as the leader of a newsroom. "What that person does means something," said Gwyn, a graduate of Midland Christian School. "When I was an intern, starting with Jay and Tatum, they were it. If I could bring a fraction of what they do, that would be the dream." Gwyn relished the opportunity of being that person, telling the day's news and getting a person ready for their next day. "I care and I get it right. I feel I could do it better than someone else." She had the keys to the 10 p.m. newscast, what she called the centerpiece for the newsroom. Gwyn turned the 10 p.m. news into something not as scripted, not robotic. Serious and still bubbly at times is how she described it. Her journalism prowess was such that she won the Edward R. Murrow, the industry's most prestigious award, according to KWES president and general manager Tim Thomas. The Permian Basin can be proud to be represented by a quality journalist like Tatum, Thomas said. She will represent Midland Odessa anywhere she goes. We are not replacing Tatum, but always seeking the best people to join our incredible team of veterans at NewsWest 9, KWES. Our goal is to represent our diverse and unique community with passion and devotion. Team announcements will be made in the days to come. In Tulsa, Gwynn is going to anchor a pair of newscasts for a locally owned station that she said has been a number one legacy station in the market. She will be paired with a co-anchor, something that will be different. She has been flying solo as a news anchor since her return to TV around 3 years ago, but she has no doubt that her broadcasting style will work, even if it pushes everyone out of their box a little. They invest into the product, the talent, Gwynn said of the Tulsa station. They're a pretty cool team to be part of. Gwynn described her time in Midland Odessa broadcasting, from the days of running the teleprompter to anchoring the 10 p.m. news, as one hell of a ride. She said she is proud of her work in front of the camera, work from a kid from here. Gwynn's last broadcast will be August 12th. This article is entitled MISD Hires Emergency Management Coordinator to Prioritize Student and Campus Safety by the Midland Reporter-Telegram. Midland ISD has named Tim Allen as the district's Emergency Management Coordinator. This new position will oversee all administrative aspects of student and campus safety, including crisis situations, natural disasters, or any other emergencies that may arise. The Emergency Management Coordinator will also serve as the district's designee and liaison on emergency preparedness issues internally and externally, coordinate and direct training programs and emergency operations drills, ensuring state and federal compliance, and assist campuses, departments with their emergency and mitigation plans. Our students are our future and our most precious resource, Allen said. It is incumbent on us to provide a safe and secure learning environment in which our students can learn and our teachers teach. MISD was in the process of hiring Allen before the Texas Education Agency's newly announced safety protocol requirements that must be in place by the start of the 2022-23 school year. Protocols include audits of current safety systems, reviews of comprehensive emergency operations plans, training for all campus staff, and mandatory drills throughout the school year. We recognize the need to provide campuses with support on all of our safety protocols, said Kelly Spencer, Chief of Administrative Services. Mr. Allen's extensive background in safety and security made him the perfect candidate to lead our efforts to keep our students and staff safe. Allen is a Texas A&M grad who spent nearly 32 years in the U.S. Army Reserve, where he rose to the rank of Command Sergeant Major. He spent the last 10 years working as an Intelligence Section Chief for the Department of Homeland Security. Allen is focused on auditing safety procedures already in place throughout the district, including the security of all exterior doors on every campus. I can't think of anything as important as protecting our students and staff, he said. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled Price of Oil Rallies Above $100 by Julia Fanzeres, Bloomberg. Oil resumed trading above $100 after the Saudis declined to make any promises regarding future output increases. A weaker dollar also helped put wider commodity markets on firmer footing. West Texas Intermediate added as much as 4.9%, aided by general risk-on sentiment rallying broader markets. Saudi ministers insisted at the conclusion of President Joe Biden's visit last week that oil policy decisions would be dictated by market logic and with coalition agreement. Iraqi's oil minister told Bloomberg he sees oil trading above $100 for the rest of the year. This week's opening rebound is largely driven by a weaker U.S. dollar and higher equity markets, said Dennis Kistler, Senior Vice President of Trading at BOK Financial. Saudi Arabia gave no signs of immediate production increases coming, which sums up to last week's sell-off probably being over-exaggerated. Crude has slumped since mid-June as concerns about a potential recession ripped through commodity markets, eroding gains that followed Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Nonetheless, Biden remains eager to get the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries to add supplies to bring prices down further and help quell inflation. OPEC and its allies next meet on August 3rd, after members agreed to revive the crude supplies that were halted during the coronavirus pandemic. Analysts at RBC see Saudi Arabia and a handful of other producers likely to making another modest supply hike. This article is entitled, Saudis, Oil Decisions Are for OPEC Plus as Biden Leaves Kingdom, by Salma El Wardani, Anne-Marie Hordern, and Matthew Martin, Bloomberg. Saudi ministers insisted that oil policy decisions would be taken according to market logic and within the OPEC Plus coalition, just as President Joe Biden wrapped up a landmark trip to the kingdom. Biden said late Friday that the Saudis shared his urgency to increase oil supply, and he expects further steps in the coming weeks to that end. Saudi officials stressed any decision to pump more would be made in the framework of OPEC Plus, which holds its next decision-making meeting on August 3rd. We listen to our partners and friends from all over the world, especially consumer countries, Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan told reporters. But at the end of the day, OPEC Plus follows the market situation and will supply energy as needed. The OPEC Plus coalition of producers includes Russia, whose oil revenues the U.S. has been trying to squeeze to punish it for its invasion of Ukraine. Riyadh was clear that it's sticking with the alliance. Biden's trip to the kingdom has been controversial at home, but gasoline prices near record levels also pose political danger. I'm doing all I can to increase the supply for the United States of America, which I expect to happen, Biden said on Friday. The Saudis share that urgency, and based on our discussions today, I expect we'll see further steps in the coming weeks. Adel Al-Jubeer, Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, played down the idea of any agreement. It's not about an agreement. It's about the kingdom's long-standing policy of working to ensure that there's adequate supply of crude oil on the market, and we follow the supply and demand situation very carefully, he told Bloomberg in an interview. If there's a potential shortage, then we work on increasing crude oil production through and with our OPEC partners and OPEC Plus partners. The alliance already moved to accelerate production increases in June after calls from consumer nations, including the United States. Still, with oil prices tumbling from recent highs as recession risks grip markets, the picture could change before the policy meeting on August 3rd. In any case, Further increases are expected to be modest as the Persian Gulf heavyweights choose to preserve their remaining spare capacity amid supply disruptions ranging from Libyan unrest to sanctions against Russia. The buffer of idle output has dwindled to razor-thin levels of just over 2 million barrels a day, according to the International Energy Agency. Under the terms of the existing OPEC Plus agreement, Saudi Arabia's production is due to reach 11 million barrels a day next month, a level it has only rarely maintained in its decades as a crude exporter. Any further increases would test the kingdom's maximum sustainable capacity, which state-run giant Saudi Aramco puts at 12 million barrels a day. This article is entitled U.S. Envoy Confident Gulf Oil Producers Will Boost Production by Victoria Cavalier, Bloomberg. A U.S. energy envoy said he is confident Gulf producers will increase oil output after President Joe Biden's visit to Saudi Arabia, where he met with regional leaders. Based on what we heard on the trip, I'm pretty confident that we'll see a few more steps in the coming weeks, Amos Hochstein, the State Department senior advisor for energy security, said on CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday. Hochstein, who was part of Biden's delegation on the visit, also cited Gulf oil producers Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates. "It's not just about Saudi," he said. "There is additional spare capacity. There is room for increased production." Biden, under political pressure from the hottest U.S. inflation in four decades, including high gasoline prices, said during last week's visit that he expects further oil supply increases by Saudi Arabia. Saudi officials stressed any decision to pump more would be made in the framework of OPEC Plus, which holds its next decision-making meeting on August 3rd. The U.S. average national retail price of gasoline soared to a record $5 per gallon for the first time in June, before retreating over concern that the U.S. economy is slowing. It was $4.53 per gallon on Sunday, according to AAA Auto Club. Prices at the pump should decline further, White House economic advisor Jared Bernstein said on Sunday on CNN's State of the Union. "I think it's very likely that gas prices continue to track down, say, for the rest of the month," Bernstein said. "I say that not because just the oil price is down 20%, but wholesale prices are down as well." Oil closed Friday below $100 a barrel for the first time since early April, amid escalating recession concerns. "We saw Saudi Arabia say that it would increase its capacity for all production, and I'd refer you to them for more information there," he said. For Americans dealing with rising prices that have been especially acute in both food and energy, the cost of gas has come down, but remains too high, Bernstein said. "We are talking about a decline that is completely insufficient when it comes to really delivering the relief to family budgets that they need," he said. Inflation has become a political problem for Democrats and the Biden administration with midterm elections in November. While Russia's war on Ukraine has roiled energy markets, Biden has also been vocal in his criticism of oil and gas companies' soaring profits, accusing them of price gouging and profiteering. "These are companies that we helped them to the tune of billions of dollars during the pandemic downturn," Bernstein said. "They ought to share some of the profitability with the American people right now."
Hello, this is Michael, reading an opinion column from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, published Tuesday, July 19th, 2022. Texas's power grid is straining, and it's not August, by Liam Denning, Bloomberg. Breaking: it's hot in Texas. Actually, though, it is really hot in Texas. Since May, the heat has been fairly persistent. On a cumulative basis, Texas's cooling degree days, an index of how sweaty conditions are essentially, are running almost a third higher than normal. That is the context for this week's two sweat-inducing notices from the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, or ERCOT, which operates the power grid in most of the state. It issued calls for Texans to voluntarily reduce demand on a couple of especially hot afternoons when it looked as if all those air conditioners might overwhelm generating capacity. As it turned out, the grid held up, but it's worth looking at why Texas's grid is struggling, especially as the even more intense crucible of August is just a few weeks away, and memories of the disastrous blackouts of February 2021 haven't faded at all. As with Winter Storm Uri, blame has been pointed at wind power. Rather than frozen blades, this week's hot, listless, air-constrained Texas's wind fleet, the largest in the country. In its conservation calls, ERCOT highlighted that wind power was running at just 9% to 12% of capacity during a couple of especially critical hours, versus the average assumption of 27% that's used for summer grid planning. At one point on Monday, wind generation dropped to only about 750 megawatts, or just 2% of capacity, as ERCOT official Christy Hobbs said at a hearing of the Public Utility Commission of Texas on Thursday. That drop actually occurred just outside of the conservation periods, which ran from 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. on Monday and 2 p.m. to 9 p.m. on Wednesday. Wind power was especially low, below ERCOT's low wind planning level, during the first hour of both of those periods. As during the big freeze, though, it would be wrong to blame all this on wind power. One of the lessons of Uri was that as complex systems with multiple points of failure, energy grids can suffer multiple compounding failures. This was made clear in Hobbs's comments at Thursday's hearing, where she said that unexpectedly cloudy weather in West Texas constrained solar power on Wednesday, and that about 7,000 megawatts of thermal generation was also offline that day. The latter, including gas, coal, and nuclear plants, are expected to be available on demand, though ERCOT factors in about 4,000 megawatts of unplanned outages in its base case scenario. The combination of temporary lulls in wind, cloud cover, and unexpected shutoffs at thermal plants led ERCOT to issue Wednesday's call to reduce demand. To avoid such close calls, Texas requires an even wider perspective. Given the trauma of February 2021, there was naturally a defensive tone to Thursday's commission hearing. Several officials were at pains to praise ERCOT for communicating its angst early, a big criticism after Uri, and also to point out that despite 8 broken records for power demand in the past month, the grid handled it. Yet, the relief is overwrought. At one point, a commissioner compared meeting those 8 days of record demand to winning 8 Super Bowls. Almost in the same breath, however, he thanked Air Products and Chemicals for temporarily turning off 3 plants to help when conditions were tight. Switching off factories to balance the grid doesn't exactly seem like a touchdown. Don't get me wrong, demand response is a powerful tool that is actually underutilized in Texas, especially with residential customers. ERCOT boasted that 500 megawatts of demand came off Monday after it issued its call for conservation. That's useful, no doubt, but less than 1% of peak demand. A formalized system of payments for turning up those thermostats or cooling homes in the morning when more generation capacity is available would surely require a bigger effort. Linked with this is a broader failure in terms of encouraging efficiency, something on which Texas scores relatively poorly. While Governor Greg Abbott hails interruptible crypto mining as a savior for Texas's grid, a dubious proposition on its own. Grants for heat pumps and insulation would do more to take pressure off the grid. While wind power's cycles up and down are well understood, hence ERCOT's planning scenarios, this week has shown that sharp declines can, in conjunction with other problems, push the grid to the edge. Yet the timing of this week's lulls suggests a ready solution in the form of more solar power, which peaks around lunchtime, and batteries, which can cover generation shortfalls for several hours.
This is the obituary column, Tuesday, July 19th. Carolina Alicia Spencer Ramos, January 2nd, 1940 to July 15th, 2022. Carolina S. Ramos, a woman deeply loved and respected by many, passed away Friday, July 15th, with her son Jaime at her side. Carolina was born in Presidio on January 2, 1940, to Charles and Josefina Colomo Spencer. She is survived by her four sons and their wives and her 11 grandchildren. Rosary will be held on Wednesday, July 20th at 7 p.m. at Nally Pickle and Welch Chapel in Midland. Funeral Mass will be held on Thursday, July 21st at 9:30 a.m. at St. Stephen's Catholic Church. Rosary will be held on Saturday, July 23rd at 9 a.m. at Santa Teresa Jesus Catholic Church in Presidio. Funeral Mass will follow at Santa Teresa Jesus Catholic Church in Presidio. Burial will be held at Desert Hills Cemetery in Presidio. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Hal Rocky Stone Dean Jr. Hal Rocky Stone Dean Jr. passed away on July 14th. He was born in San Antonio on January 12, 1951, to Hal and Stella Dean. When he was 9 years old, the family moved to Midland. Rocky loved his family and friends and will be greatly missed. Details on a celebration of life party will be forthcoming. He was preceded in death by his parents. He is survived by his daughter, Carolyn Crawley, three sisters, Ann Creamer, Don, Amy Robinette, Steve, and Nancy Dean, as well as many nieces and nephews. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Jane Ellen Pays. Jane Ellen Pays, 58, of Midland, passed away on Thursday, July 14th. Jane Ellen was born on December 27, 1963, to Judith and Walter Mises in Benton, Illinois. She is survived by her parents, her husband Robert, her son R.J. and his wife Kinsey, as well as her grandson Mason, her son Jacob and his wife Sheba. Also survived by her sisters Sharon Tiemann, Susan Dill, and Joy Sabo. She also has five nephews and nieces. The family will receive friends on Thursday, July 21st from 5 to 7 p.m. at Grace Lutheran Church, Texas Fellowship Hall. A celebration of her life in Jesus will be held on Friday, July 22nd at 10 a.m. at Grace Lutheran Church with Pastor David Rohde. Her cremains will be laid to rest in the Grace Lutheran La Mesa, Texas Cemetery, located in Sparenberg, Texas, on Saturday, July 23rd at 10 a.m. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home, and online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Michael Mike Robin Ivy. Michael Mike Robin Ivy, 60, passed suddenly from this life on July 13th. A celebration of his life will be held on his birthday, July 22nd, at Lovington, New Mexico Country Club at noon, with a private family memorial at a later date. Mike was born July 22, 1961, to William Boyd and Betty Ann Ivy Charette in Hobbs, New Mexico. Mike is survived by his wife, Cindy Ivy of Artesia, father Boyd Ivy of Denver City, brothers Mark Ivy and wife Robin of Big Spring, Marty Ivy and wife Ginger of Lovington, daughters Michelle Davila and husband Caesar of Midland, Megan Landon and husband Bryce, Jamie Dean and husband Corey of Andrews, Jade Gandy and Dalton Kuntz of Newton, and son Maxwell Ivy and wife Haley of Artesia, as well as several grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Mike is preceded in death by his mother Betty Ivy and grandparents Joseph and Estelle Ivy and Oscar and Ollie Charette. Nancy Leota Martin. Nancy Leota Martin, 81, of Midland, passed away on Saturday, July 16th. The family will receive friends on Tuesday, July 19th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home. Graveside services will be held on Wednesday, July 20th, at 11 a.m. at Rest Haven Cemetery. Nancy was born on October 7, 1940, to Eloise and Leon Freeman in Oklahoma City. She married James R. Buddy Martin on November 1, 1963. She is survived by children Barbara Amijo, Garland Butch Martin, and Heather Davis, as well as 6 grandchildren and 12 great-grandchildren. She is preceded in death by her husband, James R. Buddy Martin, and son, James R. Jimmy Martin. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to Hospice of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Death Notices. Alan Keith Morgan. Alan Keith Morgan, 64, of Midland, passed away. The family will receive friends on Thursday, July 21st, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held on Friday, July 22nd, at 11 a.m. at Mid-Cities Community Church. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Cemetery. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Debbie Duke. Debbie Duke, 49, of Midland, passed away July 13th. A visitation was held from 6 to 8 p.m. July 18th at Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held Tuesday, July 19th at 10 a.m. at Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home Chapel. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Jimmy Wayne Townsend. Jimmy Wayne Townsend, 76, of Midland, passed away on July 15th. Celebration of life will be held on Tuesday, July 26th, at 2 p.m. at Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. John Henry Crow. John Henry Crow, 69, passed away July 16th. There will be no service. Cremation arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home. Mickey Taylor. Mickey Taylor, 79, of Midland, passed away on July 15th. The family will receive friends on Friday, July 22nd, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held on Saturday, July 23rd, at 10 a.m. at Nellie Pickle and Wells Chapel. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Cemetery. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Raquel Carmona. Raquel Carmona, 75, of Midland, passed away on Friday, July 15th. Celebration of life will be held on Friday, July 22nd at 7 p.m. at Amistad Christiana, 401 South Main Street. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home. and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Vicki Jean Mosley. Vicki Jean Mosley, 66, wondrous wife, loving mother, grandmother, creative teacher, and compassionate nurse, passed into the awaiting arms of her loving Lord Jesus on July 15th. A visitation will be held from 7 to 9 p.m. on Monday, July 18th, at the branch at NPW. A funeral service will take place on Tuesday, July 19th at 1 p.m. at Sovereign Grace Church in Midland. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com.
Good morning, this is Kim. I am reading the Odessa American. Today's date is Tuesday, July 19th. UTPB offering orientation to students. University of Texas Permian Basin hosted a two-day orientation starting Monday that featured more than 100 students. Vice President of Student Affairs and Leadership, Becky Spurlock, said they are winding down the events. Our last two-day session is next week, and then we often will host a one-day catch-up orientation right before school starts for anybody who decides to come to UTPB and couldn't make it to summer orientation, Spurlock said. Most sessions have between 120 and 150 students. We've had a great turnout, she said. Asked if the Falcon Free Scholarship has made an impact, Spurlock said, it's sometimes hard to tell, but we do see our enrollment numbers are trending positive, and we're very excited about that. We haven't had a two-day orientation in a couple of years because of COVID. We have an overnight. So I think that's a really exciting experience for a lot of students to be able to do that again. So it's been great, Spurlock added. Students check in at the residence dining hall, come to the Science and Technology Building, and check out today, Tuesday. Spurlock said there are all kinds of activities in between for students and parents, advising, financing your education, a resource and organization fair, games, a Q&A panel, first generation, welcome, are just some of the features. Orientation is about getting them connected to UTPB, getting them excited, and of course, a core feature of orientation is that they register for their classes, Spurlock said. There are a significant number of people participating from the Permian Basin, she added, but there are people from all over the country too. In addition to the in-person orientation, there is also an online version because we have many students who participate and connect with UTPB fully online, Spurlock said. Olivia Luna and her daughter Alyssa Sanchez are going for their bachelor's degree together. Luna said it wasn't really a decision to embark on their journey together. Sanchez was already planning to graduate from high school this year, and I just decided, hey, why not? I can always go back, Luna said. She added that it was a big decision to attend UTPB. She is a secretary in the Career and Technical Education Department at Ector County ISD, who plans to study business management. I work for ECISD, so I really want to move up with ECISD and get higher than where I am now, so I think getting my degree is going to help me do that, Luna said. Sanchez graduated from Odessa High School and plans to study accounting. The pair went on a tour of the campus together about a month ago. Sanchez said she mainly decided on UTPB because of Falcon Free. Luna agreed. College is expensive, and with both of us coming at the same time, that really will help us, Luna said. Sanchez said being on campus has been pretty good so far, but she does have to learn her way around. Luna said this will be her first time at college, and she's kind of nervous. I'm a freshman just like she is, she said. Luna said she graduated from Permian High School in 1999, so it's been a long time since I've been out of school, Luna said. Jason Garcia and Elijah Velarde, both Crane High School graduates, attended orientation with Brandy Garcia, Jason's mom and Elijah's aunt. Jason Garcia said UTPB isn't too far from home and it's an area that's familiar to him. Velarde said he visited campus during the year. The campus was something I liked, so this is my choice, Velarde said. Jason Garcia said the campus and the people they have met appealed to him. They both said they are a little nervous to start a new life in college. Jason Garcia said meeting new people is something he's looking forward to. Brandy Garcia said if her son decides to move out, that will make her nervous. It's just a big change, Brandy Garcia said. She added that she's very proud of both young men for going to college. I think it's something that's really going to be a benefit for them in the future, Brandy Garcia said. President Sandra Woodley welcomed the students and said they are about to invest more than $100 million in a campus transformation. But also the Mesa Building, our oldest academic building, will be completely renovated over the next 3 years, Woodley said. This is thanks to the state, the UT system, and lots of donor dollars. Woodley said there will be a 2-ton stainless steel Falcon stationed on the quad named Fiona. She's here, she's on site, she's in her crate, and she's ready to get her court, Woodley said. She also pointed out other features that will beautify the campus. The signage in and around the university will also be updated. When you come here, you'll have the opportunity to see it all happen right before your eyes. So again, thank you for choosing the University of Texas Permian Basin. I do want to say that we are dedicated to the quality academic experience that you have here. When you leave here, you will have a University of Texas education that will take you on your journey for the rest of your life, a lot to be proud of academically. But we also care that you have fun while you're here. Not too much fun, we just want the appropriate amount of fun for you to have. There are many organizations that you'll learn about today that you can get involved in. You can start your own organization. We have 16 intercollegiate sports as well. Athletics is big on our campus and lots of opportunities to plug in there, Woodley said. She added that they wouldn't get much of a library tour because it's being completely renovated. It will have beautiful study spaces and an esports arena and innovation and incubator projects for students to get involved with. Spurlock said her job is to make the campus work for the students. I've worked for 7 different college campuses over the last 30 years. I've been on a college campus since the fall of 1990 when I went to college. I'm from a small town in Texas, the first in my family to go to school. I didn't have support to go to college, and I ended up in a place quite like UTPB. And thank goodness, because the people there really saw that I needed extra help. And it was a place that offered extra help for students like me. So I love working here now at the same kind of institution, Spurlock said. I've worked with thousands of college students over the last 30 years at all different kinds of institutions. That's given me a unique view on what works in college and what doesn't work in college, she said. She added that she has one piece of advice for students. Don't suffer in silence. You've chosen to come to a campus that's small, a campus where people are going to know your name, where we're going to see each other in the quad and say hello. You're going to get to know your professors, your advisors, the staff that work here. Those of you that eat in the cafeteria, you're going to be on a first-name basis with the ladies that work up front, Spurlock said. This is the place where you're not going to hide. You've chosen to come to a place like this, so let us help. There will be bumps in the road. There will be times that things do not go as you thought they would, she added. She noted that the university has many resources to offer students. Don't sit on a problem until it gets bigger. If something isn't going the way you think it should, tell somebody. You can always find me. My hair's always some shade of pink. You don't even have to remember my name. You're just like, there's the middle-aged pink-haired lady. I see her. I'm going to get her. I will always help you, Spurlock said. Other officials and students also are available. She added that little issues are often enough to keep students from continuing their education. It's not the big bumps in the road. It's little bumps in the road. Those bumps feel big to you, but they're small to us. They're solvable, so you're not going to suffer in silence. You're going to tell somebody you need help, Spurlock said. City will look at compensation. The Odessa City Council will meet Tuesday to discuss hiring a company to take a look at how the city compensates all of its employees. According to city records, the company will be asked to look at staffing levels and compensation for public safety positions, but also develop a comprehensive classification and compensation program for the entire city. Three companies experienced in municipal employment submitted bids for the project, and city staff is recommending the hiring of Evergreen Solutions at a cost of $111,500. The last time the city performed such a study was 2013, according to documents submitted to the council. Some city management and staff are discontent about the performance evaluation and management system, the accuracy of current job descriptions and job classification, career paths and succession planning, the maintenance of the compensation system, and the flexibility to create or restructure positions within the various departments. A working group comprised of City Manager Michael Marrero, Assistant City Managers Cindy Muncy, and Philip Orutia, Finance Director Larry Fry, OFR Chief John Alvarez, OPD Chief Michael Gerke, Municipal Court Director Kimberly Joswiak, and Human Resource Director Charles Hurst selected Evergreen as their choice after evaluating three companies' proposals. In other matters, the council will hear discussion, a lease settlement agreement with UTPB for the playground and splash pad area, allotting an 11,250-square-foot dance hall to be opened at 1551 John Ben Shepherd Parkway, which is currently a retail zone. Five neighboring property owners are in favor of the proposal and four are against, citing safety concerns, lack of sufficient parking, and proximity to the nearby residential neighborhood. The purchase of two John Deere Gator utility vehicles at a cost of roughly $13,000 each and a $60,000 Toro Multi-Pro 1750 sprayer for Ratliff Ranch Golf Course. Accepting a $45,000 donation from ConocoPhillips for Odessa Fire Rescue, purchasing four Ford F-550 ambulance units for OFR at a total cost of just under $1.9 million, purchasing a $99,000 Chevrolet Tahoe for OFR battalion chiefs stationed at Fire Station 6, which covers the east and north side of Odessa and Ector County, applying for and accepting an $87,373 grant from the U.S. Department of Justice on behalf of OPD and the ECSO. OPD's portion would be used for the purchase of OPD equipment, technology. On Wednesday afternoon, the Odessa Department Corporation Board will hold its regularly scheduled monthly meeting. The board will discuss the probability of expanding its Downtown on the Rise grant program, said Downtown Odessa Executive Director Casey Hallmark. Currently, business owners and operators along Grant Avenue are eligible to receive grants up to $200,000 to improve their infrastructure and up to $25,000 to improve their facades. If the ODC and Odessa City Council agree, ultimately, those funds could be awarded to other downtown businesses not on Grant Avenue, Hallmark said. If approved, more businesses could become eligible for grant funding as well, just at a lower level, Hallmark said. The ODC is also scheduled to discuss abandoning its workforce housing infrastructure program, said ODC Chairman David Bouton. In the last few years, ODC has been offering grants to pay for a portion of housing infrastructure costs so that members of the labor board can more readily obtain housing, Bouton said. However, very few grants were awarded. Roughly $100,000 of the $5 million available, he said. As a result, the ODC is considering ending the program, he said. We're going to consider a different type of program, but I'm not sure what that will look like, Bouton said. There's still some interest in assisting with workforce housing because the cost continues to escalate. There remains an interest in certain parts of the labor force, like first responders and teachers. The ODC will also be discussing its proposed 2022-2023 General Development Plan and Budget. Quick Hits Young Adults Event. The Ector County Library, 321 West 5th Street, has scheduled origami, book exchange, and cleaner and greener through Saturday in the Young Adult Department. For a full schedule or more information, call 432-332-0633 or visit ector.lib.tx.us. Storytime. The Ector County Library, 321 West 5th Street, has scheduled story time, Mermaid Scales, for ages 0 through 6 from 10:30 a.m. to noon today in the auditorium. Call 432-332-0633 or visit ector.lib.tx.us. Free STD testing. The Ector County Health Department, 221 North Texas Avenue, has scheduled free STD testing from 8:30 a.m. to 11 a.m. and from 1:30 p.m. to 4 p.m. through Wednesday. Results are never given to anyone other than the person being tested. Call 432-498-4141, extension 0, or visit tinyurl.com/ycyjpepc. Bridge Group. The Northside Senior Citizen, 1225 Adams Avenue, has scheduled Bridge Group from 12:30 p.m. to 3:30 p.m. today. Call 432-337-5281. Women's Summer Night. Mid-Cities Church, 8700 Highway 191 Midland, has scheduled a Women's Summer Fun Night from 7 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. today at the campus courtyard. There will be an obstacle course, pickleball, cornhole, music, watching the sunset, and more. Bring a folding chair, dress, barnyard casual, shorts, tank top, sun hats. The event is free and open to all women ages 18 and older. No children's ministry available. Visit tinyurl.com/2fuawnhf. Septemberfest, Museum of the Southwest, 1705 West Missouri Avenue, Midland, are calling all artists and craft persons for the annual Septemberfest, September 9th through 11th. The show is produced with the aim of providing an exposition of high-quality art and crafts by national artists and craft persons hosted by the Museum of the Southwest. Annual attendance is 6,000, and the 2022 event will mark the museum's 53rd year. To apply, go to zapplication.org/eventinfo.php?id=10471. Call 432-683-2882 or visit museumsouthwest.org.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.